This is the Catholic Movie Guy Podcast.
Well, we're back here on the Catholic Movie Guy Podcast, just like the lady said, and today's going to be an interesting one, fitting for this time of year. When I started the podcast, I said, you know, it's a Catholic man reviewing movies, not a man reviewing Catholic movies. And today's movie will definitely test that, because it's The Shining, which is a movie that's definitely not for everybody. In fact, I recently watched it with a priest of mine, who called the movie Cheap Jack, which I'm still not sure exactly what that means. I did Google it, and I believe it's a British phrase, but it's not good. I know that. It's definitely not good. So he wasn't a big fan of it. I can see why. Even in an edited form, the movie is disturbing and not for everybody, but in its full form, there's nudity, there's profanity, there's lots of violence, lots of bad language, and lots of dark themes, certainly. So I can understand why, but I believe it's a movie that has considerable artistic merit, and for the discerning viewer, is worthy to watch. I mean, the director at Kubrick is obviously a master, and while I don't think it's his best film necessarily, it's certainly a visual masterpiece. I believe that also, you know, beneath the surface level of horror film, there are many, many, many interesting themes to be found in the movie. In fact, if you're really interested, after this podcast, there's a documentary called Room 237, which came out pretty recently. It's on Netflix, I think, right now, where, you know, many people give their more or less reasonable takes on what they think the hidden symbolism in the movie is. You know, maybe some of that's just reading too much into it, but I think some of it is worthy. We all know the basic story. A man, you know, becomes caretaker of a haunted hotel, goes crazy, and tries to kill his wife and kid. But beyond that, I think that in the movie, and definitely in the Stephen King book on which the movie's based, there are themes of, basically, it's the failure of the father that is the nexus of the horror in the story. And one of my favorite websites, the Catholic Cinephile, I can't remember the exact URL off the top of my head, but if you Google Catholic Cinephile, you'll find it. It has a great review of the movie along these lines. I want to give him some credit. Now it's time to get an outsider's perspective. And that outsider is my wife.
Hello?
Hey, honey, it's me.
Hey.
You know that movie, The Shining?
Yeah.
Did you like that?
Yee. Oh, my, no.
So without further ado, I think I'm going to go ahead and wrangle my brother, Tim, the Tim Man, as usual, to help me discuss this picture.
And we're back!
Here on the Catholic Movie Guy Podcast. Tim's shaking his head at me,
presumably.
Horrific.
Did you get the impersonation?
Yeah, that was from that thing you do.
No, it was Jimmy Fallon from Saturday Night Live.
No, this thing you do is way before Jimmy Fallon did it.
That's not what that's from, dude.
And we're back!
Yeah, that's Jimmy Fallon.
No, it's that DJ who was interviewing the Wonders.
We'll let the listeners decide, I suppose. But we're not talking about that thing you do, no matter how much you want to. We're not talking about any other movies that you like, either.
Of course not.
What we are talking about, though, is The Shining, which I know you recently watched, because we watched it together. What were your initial... First of all, was this the first time you'd seen it?
Yes, amazingly, I had never seen The Shining before. I thought it was a Jack Nicholson vehicle. How wrong I was.
Well, it is partially that, right?
Well, that's what I meant.
And I want to recommend to everyone out there, if you like The Simpsons and you like The Shining, to go watch whatever Treehouse of Horror special that is, where they take it on. In some ways, it's even better than the movie, but which episode, what was that, Treehouse of Horror 4? I want to say 4?
Me no, no.
It's either 4 or 6, or possibly 5. I think it's 5.
Yes, it's definitely within the first 15 of those.
I'm
going to
say 5, but, you know, Google it. Anyway, so what were your impressions of the movie?
I liked it, and I thought it was good, and I sensed the import of the movie without even realizing why it was important as I watched it. You could tell it was carefully made. The shots were very beautifully done for effect. I mean, as a straight horror movie, to the extent that it is it, I wasn't that horrified. I mean, you see far worse in other movies. I'm not even talking about slasher movies, but it was just a really, it was an art piece.
And I enjoyed it. It was a psychological terror. I mean, it's more about that than what you see. You don't actually see hardly anything terrifying.
Well, if my kid tells me he's got a rat living in his mouth, I'm checking out.
I know, you're greatly troubled by Rat Boy.
Yes, because obviously that's the great Satan.
Obviously. There's no other possible explanation, which I will get to in a moment.
No.
We'll put Rat Boy on hold for just a moment. I wanted to mention that the setting in which we watch this, we have a monthly movie club, which is obviously really cool. And we get together, and this month we watch The Shining, but we watch it outdoors. And there are people coming and going. They're ordering pizza. They're eating the pizza. They're smoking. They're drinking. They're moving in front of the screen. They're going to the bathroom. There's ambient noise from the woods. It's not really the best setting to watch this movie. The best setting to watch this movie would be to simulate, in my opinion, the conditions of the movie. Like, you're totally isolated in the dark, possibly empty home or hotel. If you don't have a hotel, your home will do, I think. And you just kind of let it overwhelm you. That's the best. But this was not the best setting.
No, because I saw it for the first time, and you know it's a classic, I was very into it, so those distractions didn't really bother me.
You also had the best seat because you're the closest to the screen.
Yeah, that's true. I enjoyed the movie, and it was good. I won't lie to you. It was good. I don't know how I feel about it totally. It's not my favorite movie of all time, but...
No, and there are people whose movie it is the favorite movie of all time, and I would question those people's, no offense, health if this is like something you really love, because it's not that kind of a movie to me that you just fall in love with.
Yeah, it would be very unhealthy if that was your favorite movie, because it would be kind of like in Metropolitan where Nick is talking.
Whoa! About that's a technical foul. We're not even 8 minutes into this thing. I mean, we just hit the six-ish.
It's a composite, you know, like New York.
Please. I don't want to end the podcast already.
All right. All right. I was just talking about unhealthy obsessions, is all.
Yeah, definitely, right. Definitely unhealthy. But that documentary that I mentioned in the intro, Room 237, will show you just how deep the rabbit hole goes if you're willing to go down.
That was terrific. I enjoyed that immensely. I mean,
say terrific?
Yeah, it's terrific.
My hand is hovering over the bell as we speak, ladies and gentlemen. And by ladies and gentlemen, I mean only gentlemen, and possibly not even them. But really, I mean, I should just, I gotta throw them out for using terrific.
But wait.
There's only one more syllable.
Right. You save a lot of time.
You save...
A third of the time.
Yeah, but you're sacrificing masculinity and...
I think it's jaunty. Cool. It's jaunty.
Oh, well, I'm gonna go ahead and make a point about the soundtrack since there's no transition there. I think the soundtrack makes the movie just as much as Kubrick's visual work. Particularly, there's a piece in the movie called The Awakening of Jacob by a Polish composer whose name I can't pronounce and escapes me anyway. And that movie, that piece of music, if you just go to your room, turn on that piece of music with the lights off, that's enough to just send you, you know, to the depths of hell right there. It is terrifying.
Why would you do that?
Well, you wouldn't. Well, I found it ironic because, you know, you hear the music in the movie and it's creepy. And I look up the composer, look up the piece of music, and it's supposed to represent Jacob's ladder, seeing the angels ascend and descend. I think you failed, sir. No offense. That is, I mean, maybe the demons descending, but not the angels descending.
You might be real scared.
Yeah, no, not it. Not. I mean, it's a great piece of music for what it is, but it doesn't convey that to my mind.
I enjoyed the movie immensely.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the visual beauty of the movie in the midst of the horror that takes place is incredible. The panning shots of Kubrick, the way he uses what at the time was quite an innovation with, I think it's called the Steadicam, following Danny on his big wheel around the hotel. Those shots are amazing. Especially
that's
when
an iconic shot.
Yeah, and when he turns the corner and sees the girls, I mean, that's scary.
Who dresses like that? Those girls are appalling.
So now we're commenting on the fashion of murdered girls from the early 20th century? Is that what we're doing?
What is with the socks and they got the Mary Janes on? Nobody wears this kind of dress.
Traditional.
That doesn't belong to any time.
No, I disagree. It's traditional, it's winsome, and it's wholesome.
No.
And it heightens the creepiness by its very winsome.
Those chicks are creepy, that's for sure.
Okay, I want to talk briefly about one of the theories behind what's going on in this movie beyond the surface, which seems to have some merit. And it's that basically the movie centers on the failures of Jack Nicholson as the father. He's shown throughout the movie being completely disinterested in his son, disinterested in the wife, actively mean to her. I can think of other terms to apply to him that aren't suitable for the Catholic Movie Guy podcast. But I think it's clearly, you know, his insanity is of his own doing, because he completely isolates himself not only from other people, but from his duties as a father. Beyond that, there are many theories out there about the fact that he was not just a bad father, but an abusive one, physically, as we learn in the movie, but also sexually. And I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, when you put that template over his interactions with the kid, especially the when the kid goes back to get his fire truck, it puts everything in a lot more context. Because at first you think of it as how it's presented, you know, oh, he separated his shoulder because he got mad and hit him.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, this movie came out when? This was a 70s flick, right?
Don't know if
that was 70s, early 80s, but whenever it was, you know, the big thing was, you know, the husband watches the Super Bowl and beats his wife to death. You know, that was the after-school special thing.
I think we've all been there.
Right. I mean, the sexual abuse scandals generally hadn't really made their way out in these pedophilia laws and all these registries. But yeah, when you look at the signs that Kubrick leaves, and watching that Room 237, where it is really neat to see that he meant a lot of what appears to be random in his movies. He didn't leave a lot to chance. Everything is there for a reason. And when you look at the setup, which I'm sure you'll cover, it makes some sense to do this abused child angle.
Just to interrupt, the movie came out in 1980, which you will say was the 70s.
Yeah, that is the 70s,
that is
of course.
The proper way.
I'm not an animal.
No.
The 80s are the 70s.
Right, of course.
No, 1980 is the last year of the 70s.
Obviously, and there's no argument to be had there, correct, despite the fact that it is 80.
Right, but right. Year one...
In the common parlance, that would be the 80s to most people, but they're wrong.
Yeah, they're wrong.
They're wrong about a lot of things.
Absolutely. That we're Catholic, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't buy into the world, you know?
No.
We know with what.
No, I'm not buying it.
No, it's the 70s.
You keep your cheap jack, that's what I say.
Yeah,
I don't know what that means. But back to the sexual thing. He's shown reading pornography, first of all, at completely inappropriate times, including, apparently... Playgirl. He's reading a Playgirl, which points to and then in the beginning, when Danny's getting interviewed by the therapist or whatever, pediatrician, I don't know, he's shown with his pants off and he's covering his
hoozle
private
wazzle.
Parts.
Hoozle wazzle.
Yeah, his hoozle wazzle. So I think there's a lot there. There's also more to it. I'm not going to get in depth.
I'm so straight. I don't know what Playgirl is.
Great.
Do I rewind that?
And we're back! So...
That thing you did.
Oh, my. Oh, it hurts. It hurts. It's so painful. So, yeah, I'm not going to get into the whole thing, but I think that clearly he was... his abuse of the child physically and or sexually is part of what the mayhem that follows is due to. That being said... I'm one of those people that when I see the blood rushing out of the elevators and all that, I think it's a very powerful image. A lot of people that we were watching, they're like, oh, is that grape juice?
I was thinking I was in a cranberry bug. Stephen King, you know, man.
Yeah, see, I don't know. I find that image very powerful. Obviously, it's cliche now, but it was a powerful image. Yeah, it scared me when I was younger.
I'm telling you, that was the first time I saw it. Now I'm an old man, but it didn't scare me.
No.
I think we're so desensitized to these things today. I mean, the reason the film works and is scary to me is all in Kubrick and the acting. I mean, Nicholson's a caricature of himself these days, and at least since he played the Joker. I mean, I think he is the Joker. But boy, he was terrific in that movie, especially in his evil face. He is as creepy as all get out.
I don't know. I'm a bigger Nicholson fan than you are. But I agree.
Well, the best acting is to believe that you could be married to Shelley Duvall. I could not imagine.
You know, I agree. Her eyes are large. This is a real woman, you know, so I'm going to respect her. I don't think she's unattractive. I don't.
Whew.
Yeah, I think you're, you know.
Maybe my standards are higher. I don't know.
Any listener who knows how Tim looks can go ahead and chortle at this whole discussion. That's for another day.
Ah.
So, what about the theories in Room 237? There are many. The movie represents the Holocaust.
I didn't buy that one at all.
The movie represents the whites' genocidal behavior toward Native Americans. Did you buy any of that?
Yeah. I do not buy into that theory as a theory of life or of history, but I do think that his failure as a father, the paterfamilias, the white patrimonial figure.
I'm the paterfamilias.
And if you look at this room 237 thing, I mean, I know it's so stupid, but they explain all these little hints that they drop through the scenery and through the placement of certain items, and it makes a ton of sense. And I totally think it's absolutely possible, especially that whole murder of the indigenous persons that we call Indians. That thing with the calumet cans, yeah. And I thought that guy was smoking some weed, but then when later...
No, it's got some legs. It's not most ridiculous thing.
It's fantastic.
Because Kubrick is a maniac. He doesn't do things unintentionally.
Yeah.
One thing I did want to bring up also...
The disappearing rooms was fantastic.
From the 237 is that the layout of the hotel makes no sense. Rooms aren't where they should be. People exit in one direction. The way people enter a room, I mean, they exit a completely different way. And there's windows that are impossible, especially in the hotel manager's office. And knowing Kubrick, there's no way that, you know, in another movie, in a lesser movie with a lesser director, I'd say continuity error. They just don't care. But in this movie, I think it does mean something. To me, it just is a way of him by subliminally planting all these things that shouldn't be there, all these exits and entries that don't make sense, these windows that don't make sense. He's adding to the disorientation that you feel as a viewer and that the characters are experiencing.
And he's so good, and you know that there are meanings in some of the things that he does. So you're looking for meaning everywhere, and you get a meaning, but that meaning is often a misdirection. Or is it the entering the freezer in the kitchen and coming out in an impossible way from a different angle, a different door? Different things in the freezer when Nicholson's in there versus when they're shown that by Dick Halloran?
Yeah.
Just pretty cool. I mean, it's just pretty cool, and it does disorient you.
Yeah, this is going back to earlier, but one of the scenes in the movie that is content problematic is also one of the telling ones, which is Nicholson begins to have this illicit affair with a beautiful woman who, as he's having the affair, turns into a corpse. I mean, that to me symbolizes exactly what's going on in the movie and exactly what's wrong with Jack Nicholson.
Well, it's a complete and obvious homage to Dante, which you'll know from reading your Dante.
Of course, we've all read it.
In the Purgatorio, Dante has a dream in the anti-purgatory before he enters of lust personified as a woman. She's pretty hot, you know. She's diggable. And then Virgil comes up and splits her open from head to toe, and she smells like crud.
Right.
Explaining what lust really is, and that's what Nicholson's done when he sold his soul, because what he does.
I did not see that parallel. I think that's great. That's the exact insight we're looking for on the Catholic Movie Guy Podcast, and we're back! But I wanted to add, while you're saying selling your soul, I do think it's also telling when we talk about what Kubrick's getting at, that exactly, I think it's either 1 minute and 66 seconds. It's 60, there's 666 in a row, 60 minutes, 66 seconds. Is when Jack Nicholson says to the ghostly bartender, "I would sell my soul for a drink." I mean, that kind of precision is exactly what I'm talking about with Kubrick. Of course, he does it in a profane way, which in and of itself is meaningful. But yeah.
Hashtag ghost bar.
Yeah. And by the way, the liquor selection at the ghost bar, very subpar.
Yeah.
I'm going, yeah, I mean, we're swinging. We got the flappers.
It's the 70s.
Got the 1920. 70s. No, but it's a 1920 setting when he goes back in time. That bar should be well stocked. You should at least have some moonshine, you know, something.
Well, back then,
and they had Jack Daniels. That's it. They have nothing good.
If you're trying to order Grand Chartreuse at that period, you know, the French government, which was dominated by the Freemasons, had kicked out the Grand Chartreuse from Grenoble, and they were actually off site.
This is America.
Yeah.
Tommy, we're talking about bourbon. Okay, Scotch. I know that's not American, but you know, brown liquor. That's what I'm looking for. Jack Daniels. Nothing wrong with it. I'm not. If that's your favorite, no problem. But, you know, some higher-end stuff, that's I'm looking for in the gold room. They call it the gold room.
But in the 70s, man, all you have is Jack, you know, and they thought it was terrific.
Oh, am I... You know how Mary holds back our Lord's avenging arm? That was me on the button just then from calling Tim second technical of the day. What an outrageous word that is. I can't take him out. You know, he's my brother on the podcast, but I can't take him anywhere.
I'm trying to make it stick.
Yeah, well, it's sticking to you.
Excellent.
And it's not necessarily in a good way. What else do I want to say? Now, when Jack's chopping at the bathroom door with the axe, and he pokes his head through, and we all know, here's Johnny. Why doesn't she stab him in the face? Thoughts?
That chick's crazy, man. She's threatening him with a knife that she holds limply.
Yeah, I mean, that knife, if she touched him, it would fall out of her hand.
Oh, and she's backing up the stairs with the bat in a way that he could not possibly be afraid of her, which is another room two.
Yeah, that was an interesting theory, too.
That the kid's using the shinning to draw the mom back, yes. so dad can get whacked real good.
Now, we had a disagreement over this. The name of the movie, The Shining. I'll take the pro position. To me, the kid has a gift from God. Dick Halloran has a gift from God. It is an ability, a supernatural ability to see future and past events, and it's what saves his life and saves his mother's life under this theory, which is that he's drawing her away from the danger and drawing his father into the bat. He manages to escape through the hedge maze through the same ability. But you, I think, when we watch the movie, you seem to think it was some sort of preternatural or demonic.
Of course. I mean, that's obvious.
It isn't obvious, though. Why?
Because people don't have rats that live in their mouth who tell them what to do. You don't hear voices. That's all.
I attribute that, the rat thing, is a sexually abused boy trying to express himself and deal with the emotional trauma he suffered.
He says the thing lives in his stomach. It turns into a boy that lives in his stomach. And I think, you know,
to me, that's an imaginary friend situation.
If you read Father Gabriel Amorth, you know, the chief exorcist of Rome, you read his books, you know, a lot of times demonic possession is, the symptom of it is non-specific abdominal pain. You hear voices, they think it's psychological, it's not. This kid has a preternatural occult thing that he uses, much like Harold Potter. Sometimes for good, sometimes for bad. It's fine.
You're the preternatural pediatrician. That's what you are. I mean, you're not qualified to make this diagnosis. But
absolutely.
Put that to the side. Put the boy in his stomach. The shining in and of itself is a good thing. It's a gift.
I don't know about that.
It can't be.
If you have access to the occult, that's prohibited under the first commandment.
Okay, but why I'm talking about within this movie. I'm not talking about the real world. Within the framework of this movie, it's a good thing that saves him and his mother. Not demonic.
Some people use white magic to heal themselves of bad breath.
And this is why we can't have good things, ladies and gentlemen. All right, I'm wrapping this up.
No way. Because I have an unpopular opinion. Look, just like you're trying to ostracize me, Nick in the...
That's a technical. I'm going to allow Tim, as he makes his way off the court, to give his final Tim Man rating. How many out of 10, Tim?
I'm going to go ahead and give the 7.9 out of 10.
7.9, the Tin Man's.
Yes.
Go ahead.
The Tin Man, 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 the Tin Man.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Catholic Movie Guy Podcast. We're glad that you joined us. Enjoy Halloween or All Hallows Eve, whether you celebrate it if you're a modernist or you don't, you're a traditionalist, or you kind of do if you're me. You know, get some candy and have some fun, everybody. So we'll see you next time, eh? Till then, Steve out.
See you.
If you like the music, it's called Waste Technology by Jazar. BetterWithMusic.com. Check him out. Until next time, I am the Catholic Movie Guy.